This podcast is brought to you by Amusement Warehouse Magazine, the industry's largest trade publication. We cover amusement parks, carnivals, fairs, festivals, history, safety columns. We really got it all when it comes to the amusement business. Only remaining print publication in the amusement industry on a regular basis. So if you're interested in what the amusement industry has to offer, subscribe today. You can subscribe by logging on to amusementwarehouse.com, carnivalwarehouse.com, or amusementparkwarehouse.com. Welcome to another edition of the Amusement Warehouse Podcast. Today, we have a very special guest. I'm very, very excited. Mr. Guy Levitt from Ray Kamik Shows, who got up before the crack of dawn to come on from the West Coast. Thank you so much for joining me. We really appreciate it.
Oh, glad to be here.
It's great. I got so much to ask you about Ray Kamik Shows. I don't know if you know it or not, but I've kind of been obsessed with your show ever since I got into business. When I went to Houston years and years ago for the IFE, they had a marketing zone meeting over there, and I made so many notes. We didn't have digital cameras at the time, but I brought a camera with me. I took about 8,000 pictures, and I couldn't believe all the things. I was new to the business, so seeing some of the things that were there that I had talked about on some of the East Coast was just amazing thing for me. But I want to ask you first, how did you get started in the industry? I know obviously Ray Kamik and you're involved, but how did you personally get involved with the,
Well, my parents were in the carnival business and so were my wife, Charlene's. Yes. So there's two families involved here in this one company now.
Oh, wow. What did your parents do?
My dad built homes, in the '40s, and in 1950, the boom was over in Washington. So he was stuck with a house and he traded it for a merry-go-round. And that's how he got started into it. And he just started doing amusement or city parks around the state of Washington and Oregon. And in the summertime and in the wintertime, he was a heavy equipment operator. And so that's how he made a living back then.
Wow.
Did you get to operate
some of the merry-go-rounds, or was that your job?
I got to help set up and tear down, sure, obviously. And sell tickets and stuff. But I was quite young then. So then he starved out in Oregon and moved to Arizona. They were headed to San Diego because they figured it wouldn't be raining and bad weather like that we had in Oregon, because he couldn't work. He couldn't work with heavy equipment. He couldn't work the merry-go-round. And got to Los Angeles, came to Phoenix, and then we just kind of settled here. So
how'd you eventually meet Charlene and get involved with the Ray Kamik Shows?
Well, my father built up his arsenal of rides, and he played the Four Corners states, and he retired when I was in college the first time, and he'd already been working 25 years by that time. And so he thought it was time for retirement. And so I went for 2 years in school, and then I said, I've got to go out in the summertime and make some money. So I set up an appointment in Las Vegas back then at the IFE with three different candidates that I could go work with and run my business along with it, because I was in the game business back then. And I met Ray Kamik. The very first appointment was with Ray Kamik, and he and his wife, Verl, were this wonderful to me. I called the other two and canceled. We just hit it off. It was just like magic. It was just crazy how that worked. And so I joined his carnival. And then my father came out of retirement like 5 years later, because I've got a younger brother named Mark. And my dad was bored to death, and he'd retired too early, and he got back into the business. And he picked up about the same route that he had before. But I started off with Ray, and we went to Canada back then. Ray went clear up into Canada, and Ray started his company in 1962.
I just heard about the Canadian part the other day. I had no idea that you guys went to Canada. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, we played the B circuit up there. We were there for 7 weeks and played 13 dates and never closed for 7 weeks. There were circus jumps. It was just horrendous. And the Canadian dollar got so low that I talked Ray, and his contracts were ended in 1978 or 79, somewhere in there. And I said, let's just get out of Canada. We can make more money in the States, I believe. And so we did. And that was a good move at the time.
And those roads are beautiful up there in the western part.
Yeah. and no directional signs, nothing. They had to arrow the routes back then. It was quite an experience.
Tommy Coffing was telling me, I interviewed him a month or two ago, but the first time they went west, he said the trucks, there were parts laying all over the place. He followed the truck in, and he said he just was picking up pieces of rides as he went over west. Yeah. So I know it's tough. The Vivonas once told me too that when it was available to bid on, Morris actually was, he's like, I drove out there. He's like, there's no way our trucks will make it out here. It's like impossible.
Well, and a lot of our fares up there, we had to be pulled onto the lot and off of the lot with big four-wheel drive tractors because it was raining and it was muddy and, they were just grass lots, fairgrounds. It was, they were wonderful people. We loved working up there. The kids were fantastic. And so it was a great experience for me.
And they appreciate you so much coming in.
Oh, for sure. Yep.
That's a nice feeling always. So you were pretty involved by that time? Were you, by the time you left the Canadian, because you told them to get out of Canada, so you must have had some voice there.
Yeah, yes, I think so. The last 2 years before Ray's passing, I managed the company. So it was working out well. It was a nice step up at the time.
Yeah, I never knew Ray, but Gary Ottobacher and some other people have told me that they used to have like a secret racquetball league that they played in. Apparently Ray was very, very good. He was a big guy, he said, and really tough to beat. And it was a few, Bernard Thomas and Frank Zajac, and there's two or three others, but it gives you back to that time. It's I can't imagine. Well, maybe I could imagine, but it'd be weird to see like five, six big carnival owners playing racquetball at the conventions and things. It's pretty
neat. Sure. Ray and Bernard Thomas went to the national doubles final when they played in Lenox, South Dakota. They used to go to the YMCA every day, and that's where they got their start, because Ray lost a lung during World War II, and his doctor said, you got to expand your other lung. And he said, the best way to do it is just, take up a sport. Why don't you join me? The doctor saying this, why don't you join me down at the YMCA in Sioux Falls? And that's where he got his start. And of course, Bernard chimed in, and then, every convention we'd go to, there'd be a racquetball game someplace. It was fun. We enjoyed it.
That's pretty neat. That's a cool little thing that they did together. Yep. So coming back to the States, you played at that, when you left Canada, where did you replace it with? What states were you playing? Where'd you go?
Well, we'd come out of Canada and go to Great Falls, Montana to the state fair, then the Central States Fair in Rapid City. Then we would jump clear over to the Western Idaho State Fair in Boise, Eastern Idaho in Blackfoot. And then from there, we'd go down, and after he bought our Fraser shows, we picked up Albuquerque. We'd go play Albuquerque, and then we'd go from there clear down to Texas. And then we'd turn around in Texas just before Thanksgiving week and come all the way back to Colorado, where he was based at back in those days.
You said it was Art Shaver shows?
Art Fraser.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Fraser shows. Yeah. Yep. Okay. And then didn't he eventually buy Hildegoss out too?
No.
Oh, no.
No, when after Ray's passing, we lost the New Mexico State Fair. We went a year without a big fair. That was our big fair of the year. And I just picked up the IAFE book and looked at the dates, and I said, "Oh, look, the Los Angeles County Fair is the exact same dates.
Yeah, why not?
what do I have to lose?" So I picked up the phone and called the manager and set up a meeting. But we wound up with that fair, and Lloyd Hildegoss had it before, prior to that.
Played
and
his before wife, you, okay.
Yeah, and his wife got sick, and he hired a guy to come in and run his company. And long story short, they wound up, not playing the fair anymore. So we wound up with the Los Angeles County Fair, which was the largest county fair in the United States at the time. Still is.
Even though Spencer, Iowa claims to be.
Yeah. And that was exactly. Well, yeah. 1983, it was when Ray passed away, and we played Los Angeles County Fair for the first time in 1985. And we would jump from
a nice jump. I mean, a nice step up.
It was. We would jump from Blackfoot, Idaho, 810 miles, close on Monday, which was Labor Day, and open that next Friday in Los Angeles. So it was quite a jump, but we'd been used to making fast jumps, but not with that much equipment. And unfortunately that year, 1985, that summer, I had my father lined up to bring in his equipment because we didn't have enough equipment to cover a fair that big. And he got killed in a car accident that July, and we opened in September at the Los Angeles County Fair. So my brother and my mother and all their crew and their carnival came in and helped us without my father, but it would have been great to have him there. So,
and when you got in New Mexico, that's right. You brought Frazier. I was doing a little studying. It's tough to find history of Ray Kamick shows actually on the internet. It's like very, it talks about today, but not a lot of the past, but I talked to some people I knew, but, you didn't have New Mexico like for a long time. It was pretty relatively short, right?
We had the last 2 years of the contract.
Years of the contract.
Yeah. Ray was there for the first one and he passed in 83. And then in 84 was our last year there. I'm sorry. 83. Yes.
And with Hillegas, I'm curious, you're known now for all the amenities and all the things you did, but, some people have told me that, Hillegas had some pretty cool amenities back in the day. He was like one of the first people to put up some umbrellas and seating and things like that. Was that your impression or was he an influence at all on that? Or,
you know, his wife was just like my wife, a very classy lady, did a lot of neat things like that on the Midway. They did a little bit of that, not to the extent that we do it.
No. And yeah, of course.
Yeah. And I think somebody had
to start somewhere with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, if you can't go visit somebody else and steal a couple of ideas and bring them back and put them in your own, then you're not paying for your trip. And I tell all my employees that too, and my family, when you go to see somebody else, bring back an idea, pay for the trip. Yeah. And so that, yeah.
Or an amusement park, I guess, too. You learn a lot from some amusement parks.
Exactly. Actually, L.A., we're right there in the middle of, you know, Knott's Berry Farm, Magic Mountain, Universal Studios, name it. You know, they've got entertainment everywhere in Los Angeles. So we're right in the middle of it. You have to do something a little bit different in order to survive. And now we do the Orange County Fair, and we're about 12 minutes from Disneyland at the Orange County Fair.
That's pretty neat. Yeah. So at that time, you really hit the big league. Well, when you bought Frazier, was the intent to get bigger, to play bigger events and do more? Or what was your thought process back then?
That wasn't mine. That was Ray's. And the answer to that is yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
he did that. We wound up with the Pima County Fair, which is the largest running fair that we've been at. We've been there since 1980, and, you know, still have a great relationship with them. That was the first fair of the season. And then one of the last fairs of the season was Albuquerque on Art Frazier's route. And we needed those two dates to fill in the beginning of our route and the end of our route.
Yeah, they run like right after Labor Day, right?
Yes. And then when I went down and booked the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, that was the first one that we ever did a formal presentation. Charlene and I went down and did a formal presentation down there. That was the very first time we'd ever done that. Because always before, it was, you know, handshakes and meet people and, you know, cut a business deal and those kind of things. That was kind of the old way of doing it. And I came back. We were playing in California, and I stopped at the airport, bought a Texas hat, put it on my head, and I came walking back on our Midway when I got back to California. And all of my staff said, really? We're going to Texas in February? You know, because they always had that time off. We didn't open up until, you know, the end of April at Tucson in the Pima County Fair. And they were upset. Oh, my gosh, now we have to work in the winter, too. And the first 2 years, we lost money in Houston.
Did you really?
Oh, yes.
Because of the jump?
Yes, the jump and the weather. And it was because it was in February. The whole event was in February. And eventually, we talked them into moving into April and picking up, or into March and picking up spring break. And that was just the game changer for sure.
And what year was that? Did you get Houston?
1985.
Oh, wow. It's been forever. Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry. 1995.
Oh, 95.
Yeah. 94, yeah. We got the Orange County Fair in California to go along with Los Angeles. And then in 95, we got Houston.
That, yeah, I remember because I was in the industry when you got, I thought I was, but then I thought maybe I forgot. Yeah.
Nope.
But, I remember it was a big, big news because you were coming out of California and going to Texas was just a tremendous move, and it was big news in the industry, that's for sure.
We moved 400 loads down there starting in January, you know, for a March event.
Now with that proposal, you made did you make a lot of new ideas and incentives to move into Houston?
Yeah, a lot of things differently than they'd had in the past. the biggest thing I think that helped was, like, 2 years later, I hired the Heather Woodward from Miami Dade County Youth Fair to come out to California and teach us about her pre-sale program.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And I also had invited one of the people from Texas to come there. And out of all of our events, Texas was the only one that really picked up the pre-sale thing and ran with it. And now we have volunteers selling pre-sale there that's just over the top. So that's kind of like, you know, that money is in the bank before we even open up down there. And they just do a fantastic job. And I think we had about like 1,700 pre-sale people working on the program last year.
Jeez, army.
They do a phenomenal job. All volunteers. And that's just wonderful.
Yeah, and it's last paycheck's money, and they yep. have some fresh money to spend. That's a tremendous thing. You had, I think it was might have been the year I went out there, you had like you tried the X layout. Is that there?
Oh, yes. Yep. We have that everywhere. Just about everywhere we go.
Because the merry-go-round was in the middle. And yep. And I don't remember if it was Texas or Phoenix where the merry-go-round, I guess one of the states, there was no, well, you had bushes around it, not like metal fence. You had like hedges basically around the ride,
right.
Because there was no, I guess, law on having to have gates or something like that. But it was pretty. It looked great.
Well, going back to my childhood days, I ran the merry-go-round after I got old enough, you know, on the weekends and stuff when I wasn't in school. And we never had a fence around our merry-go-round. And my father taught me back then, because it was a 22 Parker, it had a brake and a clutch on it. You could stop the horse right where the parents were standing when they put their child on the horse. So they didn't have to walk halfway around the machine. And when you're busy, that's very important, because when you got a crowd, you can't, you know, have people bumping into each other. They just reach up, grab the child and take them off the horse. And I hated a fence. And when I started doing the research, California's the one that made us go to a fence in our carousel because they had fence laws. And a carousel has been around, or a merry-go-round has been around since the year 500 AD.
Really?
And I said, I said, people know that the thing is going to start. And of course we had a bell. You ring the bell before the thing starts. You know, you get the thing going, but they finally forced us to it. I finally gave in, and instead of putting a fence around it, we just put a hedge around it, and it was enough to block the people, and they went for that. So, and then of course we had to have the gate to keep, you know, protect the people against themselves.
It's like valet service. You deliver them right back to their parents.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's pretty neat. So you'd stop them and give them right to their parents.
Yep.
When did you, I mean, was it all the time, or maybe it was Ray Kamick or you or Charlene or whoever, but when did you really put such an emphasis on amenities and looking different? Or was that always going to be your sort of universal selling point for the carnival?
No, when Ray passed away unexpectedly at 59 years old, my father died at 54. Yeah, he was 59 when he passed away with a heart attack down in Tampa. He was a salesman. When he walked into a room, he was kind of like a John Wayne. When he walked into a room in his cowboy boots on, everybody kind of paid attention to him. When he talked, everybody listened, and he was a salesman. He started out, his father and he had the Chevrolet garage in Lenox, South Dakota, when he went to work for Bernard Thomas. Way back in the day. So he could sell, you know, ice to an Eskimo. He was just that good. I'm not a salesman. And so Charlene and I sat down and said, well, we have to build a product that's better than any other product. And these fairs are going to recognize it, and then they're going to want, you know, to have that nice product, just like you saw when you came to Houston. And that's the direction we went. So we did stuff out of the box. And I also, when I joined Ray, I had games, but he said, I don't need another game operator. I need somebody to run my kid rides. And so we went partners in the Kiddyland business. And so I ran all of Kiddyland. Well, the first thing I did is put in benches and places to sit down and shade structures for the customers. Cause I watched the grandparents push the stroller over, get their grandchildren out, and they would sit on our bench and just send the kids back and forth to the ticket box all the time, buying more tickets. They didn't want to leave that bench. They liked sitting there. And, you know, before that, they just stood around, and pretty soon they'd leave. And that was the wrong, you know, atmosphere. So a lot of those things I learned in the early ages of, you know, running kiddie rides, and that helped a lot. And we never changed that format. We just kept adding to it.
Yeah, you continue to do it today with new incentives and new amenities and new things all the time there. Because sometimes people go, oh, what the heck is he doing that for? But they seem to work out pretty good with what you're doing.
I think my brother told me that because he kind of handles the Midway beautification program along with a lot of other duties. But he said we got, I think, 14 semi-loads of Midway beauty stuff that we have. That, you know, like you said, boss, these don't take a, they don't take a ticket. All these tickets, all these, all this equipment doesn't take one ticket. I said, you're right, but it keeps the customers here and they spend more money.
Yeah, eventually they do buy a ticket, actually, in a way, because they're there longer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you've been doing that. The first time, like I said, I went to see you was in Phoenix. I was working for Amusements of America at the time. And, you know, I was fairly new to the carnival business. And I was thinking of some of the, you know, I don't want to say, I was going to make a joke and say, they got all my ideas over here. I was thinking of some of the, like, photo opportunities and different things. And I was always getting resistance and pushback. And then I went out there. I was like, holy mackerel. They got everything at this place. It's unbelievable. And I was watching, I was going things. And, you know, it's funny because I actually, that was the first time I ever met you. I went up to you. I must look like an idiot. I was just out of college and I was just overwhelmed. No. I said, hi, Mr. Levitt. I'm Ron Weber. I said, you have such a beautiful show. And you said, thank you. And then you left. That was a thing. A couple of years later, though, I got to meet Tony Fiore.
Oh, yes.
Which was, you know, I was floored by that, too, because I he came to me in IFE. I'd written something for the OEBA or done something. And he came up and he said, I read your thing, what you wrote. I was intrigued by it. I'd like to have lunch and discuss it. And I said, I'm just a kid. I don't know. Who's this guy? Why is he asking me about the thing? But he's always so nice to me, you know, for if I had questions or I thought of anything, Tony would always be open. His door would always be open to discuss things and do things. And I'll always remember that. And, you know, he invited me, or I told him I was coming to Phoenix whenever I came. It's been a while. I think he was sick then when he came. He was just, and all your staff, really just tremendous. When I went to Phoenix, I was floored by your customer or your employee break areas were just phenomenal. I mean, the places that people could rest and hang out and, you know, have place to go, the ticketing system. And a lot of people had fun. I know you have like a variation of the old fun card system that you've souped up, but the scanning went so quickly, you know, cause it was boop, you know, and you're on. Whereas a lot of the people I saw that had it, or I was running an event that, you know, maybe straight shows had it or somebody else had it. It was slower, and yours was, I was like, how is there so fast? And then I learned that you had done some tweaks to it to make it a whole different type of system, that, you know, the layouts, the way the games looked, all those things were just kind of a step ahead at the time. So I've always, you know, looked at that. But how important was the ticketing system to you and soup and making that really a first-class operation with that?
Well, it was day and night difference. I'll back up just a little bit, because the reason I got into the ticketing system was I decided to incorporate and put all the games in-house. And so I went to our four concessionaires that we had at the time, and I said, I would like to buy you out and make you partners, and you can come here. Two of them joined us, and two of them didn't. Two of them left. And that was their prerogative, you know. But I wanted to own all the games so I can control all the merchandise in the stock. And so for a year and a half, 2 years almost, we ran them with cash. And I had more partners out there on the Midway than I ever wanted in my life. And the straw that broke the camel's back, and I had been looking into the ticketing system. I went to Conklin's name. I went to two or three different places looking at different ticketing systems. And Ron Burback had one that he was using up in the Northwest. And I went to look at his, and he operates all of his own games. So he kind of helped me get back into the game business. But I was walking down the Midway in Phoenix, where you're just talking about, with Annie Castle, one of our concessionaires. And she said, I want to show you this new thing that I'm doing. We're about halfway there. And back then we were hiring kids out of church groups come out and work in our games. And she said, look, excuse me just a minute. And she pulls this kid out and we walk around behind one of the fun houses. And she says, little Johnny, she said, your shirt is sure wrinkled. And she reached down and pulled his shirt up, and the cash just fell out all over the ground. And I'd already been looking at the ticketing systems, and I just went, that's it. We're going cashless right now, because I don't need all these partners. And we did. We switched over and went. We actually picked up and went with Burback's system back then, and we've modified it many, many times over because of the speed and because of all the things that you need to make it work. And it's fantastic.
He probably just didn't have pockets or an apron. It's probably an innocent excuse.
Oh no, he had all he needed. He had everything. And now we go through about on average. I think last year in Houston we went through 125 semi loads of teddy bears, and now we're buying skins and we're stuffing our own also on top of that. So,
jeez.
Yeah, it's a whole different kind of game operation than 99% of the carnival business has.
So. Yeah, no, it is. Well, probably at least any major carnival. I think you're the only big carnival that does that.
Yeah.
So are you using groups now still? Or are you doing employees?
Actually, we're going after sports teams at high schools and colleges. And that's our game operators. They come money. Out. That's well, we donate to the schools and they come out and work for their team and whatever. They always need everything. They need jerseys. They need trips they got to take. They've got the first group that Annie hired. Annie's in charge of that whole thing, by the way. She does a fabulous job with it, along with everything, all of her other duties or hats that she wears. But in Houston, she went down to downtown Houston and hired a wrestling team from the high school. They were wrestling on the asphalt and the concrete. They didn't have enough money to buy mats to wrestle on.
Oh, no.
And, she felt so bad. So, she went down there, and they were great workers. And they come back every year. And they tell their friends, year after year, you got to run out and work the rodeo, or you got to run out and work the fair. So every place we go, we hire high school kids now and college kids to come out.
Marching bands might be good too. They're always looking to
raise any of them. We're not we don't pick on anybody. Yeah, we don't discriminate. That's right.
So the game operation is changed considerably, and then you keep or whoever you have doing that keeps track of prizes that are given out percentage wise and stuff like that, and you want to hit a certain number of prizes to dollar spent and things like that.
Absolutely. We try to hover right around the 30% rate. And it's amazing because when you stand on our midway and look, you can see every third customer's got a teddy bear under their arm, or they've got a backpack full of them because we give away clear backpacks now and they just stuff them in there. You can tell right away that there's a lot of merchandise on the midway just by looking at the customers. You don't have to look at the game and see that it's half full or half empty. And we have an 8-man crew that does nothing but bring teddy bears all day long into the games, because of the amount of merchandise that we give away.
That you get, and you're saying it pays dividends, right? People are more inclined to play the games, or less scared of the old, going to beat me for all my money or whatever else, that they're not going to get a return.
The real truth is, we never made money in the game business until we got into doing it this way. Now we make money with games.
That's pretty neat. And you think the immediacy of the prize is really important, because I had wondered why nobody has like a giant, sort of redemption system or something like that. Somebody that's going to do what you're doing, why they wouldn't have, something. Because I grew up in New Jersey. I used to go to the shore for the week with my parents and my sisters. And we would, play, like my mom would play the little like Skillo, like bingo, roll the ball.
Right.
And I would play some different games. We'd get tickets and we'd all save up all week. And then we'd buy, some stupid thing, waffle lamp or some ridiculous thing. But I always wondered if you couldn't have, or maybe a smaller show couldn't have, a redemption system like that with incentives to play more, so you want to save up more tickets and get something bigger rather than the immediate. I know there's a big thing with the immediate getting the prize, but I was just always curious why the, I knew one guy that tried it in Georgia at one time, but Hugh McNair, I think, did it for a while. But
We looked into it. It's a little bit complicated for a traveling carnival like we are. I think it's better when they're in a stationary location to do that kind of stuff. I'm like you, though. I think the immediate win, that toy, the kids get excited. They want to play some more. We're an impulse industry. The whole industry is impulse, basically.
And the whole country is.
when you can hand a kid out their little favorite toy that they just, played to win. When we start out in Kiddyland, we have games in Kiddyland, and a lot of our games in Kiddyland are winner every time. So it's a no-brainer. They're winning as soon as they step up to the game and start playing.
Right.
And so
it's a big part of the industry that's been going through some changes the last couple of years, and what the solution is. And if you're saying yours is working really well, that's great, because I miss a lot of the games that even when you used to play, like I used to love playing glass pitch or something with the quarter down the shore with the, I know it's impossible to do because it's heavy and all those things, but you know, milk can games or all those games that were really fun to play, but they just, you know, there's bushel baskets and balloon throws and, you know, plus all the group games and that's about it. But there's we're missing a lot of the games we used to have that it's a shame there's no variation of them anymore.
You talk about Tony Fiore. Let me back up to his story for just a minute. He and I pulled on the lot in Colorado Springs in a shopping center with Ray Kamek the very same day, the very same hour. We pulled in within an hour of each other. He came from California for the first time. I came from Arizona for the first time, and we met at that shopping center. He had two games because he was with Lloyd Hildegoss for a while, and the gypsies out there taught him the game business. So he had a glass pitch and a dime pitch, and he came up to join us. We got to Canada, and his dime pitch for Teddy Bears, they were throwing dimes back then, got shut down in Canada because he was defacing the queen, according to the Mounties in Canada.
Oh my gosh.
So he runs down to the nearest hardware store, gets some washers out of the hardware store, the same size as a dime, came back, and he's selling washers instead of dimes, you know, for the kids to throw. Well, every other kid in town knew where the hardware store was at.
Like counterfeit tickets. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And so, long story short, he played about two more dates and turned around and said, I've got to go back. I can't make it up here. And he went back to Santa Rosa, California. I wound up booking the Santa Rosa Fair, Charlene and I did, years later. And who comes out to visit us but Tony Fiore? And for 3 years, he said every year when we got there, he said, I'm going to run away with you. I'm going to join the carnival again. And on the third year, he came out. He had bought a trailer and a truck, and he said, I'm going. I don't care. You don't have a job. I'll make my own job. And he was with us till he passed. He was just a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy. I know to me, I always remember that with how he reached out to me and helped so much with so many people. But, you know, it's weird. Those little interactions really shape you a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
With what you do. So, you know, another really cool thing you did, I have in Pete Downs on, who's our podcast biggest fan, by the way. He's probably watching it right now. He made a shirt. He came to IAPA with a shirt that he made himself of the podcast that he wore.
When he came. Wow.
I was like, what are you, nuts? But he when he did your canvas, redid your canvas, and you did it with those, he said it was Charlene's idea to have those little facade things around them, like they look like medieval castles almost to a certain extent.
Sure.
Those are really unique looking with the gold and the red. And that was a tremendous, you know, different. When you look at it, you just say, this is different. This is something that's really special.
And my brother made all those. He's very talented young man. he did all of that stuff, in the shop and stuff.
He couldn't find like the right things to fit, something like, he looked all over the place. Couldn't find them. So he just made them himself.
Just made them. That's right. Absolutely.
So all the games now have that structure, I guess.
Correct. Yes.
That's incredible. So you know, in the carnival, when you were moving around, doing the things you used to do to, you know, becoming what you are now, was it a planned thing to do just several events, space them out to give yourself time to get there and set up and do a tremendous, tremendous job playing it? You know, is that like a conscious plan that you had, or just kind of come about, or?
Well, both of our fathers died within 2 years of each other. So Charlene and I stepped back and said, oh my gosh, now we're operating two carnivals, and she would be on one, I'd be on the other one, or vice versa. And I had one good electrician. I had one that wasn't that good. You know, he's an assistant or something on the other one. There was always a problem with employees and a problem with everything. And I finally said, you know, what we do best is operate one carnival. So we contracted there's a little park here in Phoenix in Cano Park. The gentleman had passed away. The city put $11 million into redoing the park, but they needed an operator and some rides. So I had a surplus of rides. Santa Monica Pier out in California called, and they needed some rides to go next to their 100-year-old carousel. And so we took seven rides out there. So we started splitting up all the surplus equipment. And then I said, you know, we've got some good dates and we've got some not so good dates. Let's get rid of the not so good dates and let's increase the good dates. And so that's kind of how we wound up with one carnival operation. Most carnivals across the country have 4, 5, 6 units. And then for their big events, they bring them all together or bring part of them together. And that's kind of the standard in the norm in the industry. we decided not to do that. I decided to start playing bigger events and keep us as, you know, one operation, so that we had the best electricians, we had the best, you know, painters, we had the best game people, we had the best, you know, food people, and that's how we do it.
And really, you could really only do what you do at big spots. It'd be really tough to make a day or two jumps and set up the stuff that you're saying. Right. Be impossible. I mean,
and my father-in-law played 37 events a year, and my dad played 30 events a year, and we're playing 6 events a year. So there's a big difference. I keep telling everybody I can't seem to keep a date, but I don't want to keep some of those dates, you know, because they're just they're never going to grow. And to operate and manage a company the size that we are now, you have to have a you know, a good sized date to do that.
There's still play that like high school date or something? It was like a high school or something. You played it for a long time.
We used to play the U of A spring fling.
Yeah, that's what it was.
They shut down in COVID, and in their infinite wisdom, they decided not to reopen after.
Oh, no.
Yeah. We started it in 1980. So we played it for up till COVID.
Tony used to tell me you played it for forever.
Oh yeah. And it was a fun event because it was the sororities and the fraternities that would come out and put up their booze. And it was just fun working with those kids. They were so energetic, and they learned more about business and customers and all that kind of stuff. Marketing, they learned all that stuff in that one weekend, because they worked on it all year long, but it was a, you know, 3-day event, and it was fantastic, and it was just wonderful. We loved it just because of the atmosphere.
That's one of the things that got me, not really got me, but I was thinking about the carnival business when I was in college. I went to William and Mary in Virginia, and we were talking about some group I was in about having a carnival, and you know, I was like, how the heck do you call a carnival? Where are they? I was like, how do you find one? I don't know where they are.
Sure.
But now it must be easier with the internet and everything else. But, you know, it's funny putting yourself in the other shoes, the shoes of the potential client. Like, where would they find a carnival back then anyway? So it was that always intrigued me, because I remembered in New Jersey, my church used to make some money from a carnival somehow. I knew it was a big part of the budget. So I knew you could make some money from it, but just right. Didn't know how. But I thought it would have been a great thing to have it on campus, like you're saying, to do the things. But yeah, I mean, you stopped playing. You played a couple of shopping centers back in not that long ago, and Tony was still around a little bit, because I used to needle him because he played. We only play 4 fairs or something like that. I said, Tony, you play this shopping center thing. He said, well, that doesn't count. A couple of things, but now you're just really down to a compact route and.
We haven't played a shopping center in quite a while, and nothing wrong with shopping centers. They're not the events that we're looking for.
But sometimes they you know, I forget what happened. You used to have like, was it the California State Fair, one of those, and then some dates conflict and somebody went like an extra week or something happened, or you got a new spot and you actually had to give up like a state fair to play or something like that.
Sacramento, California State Fair. Yes.
And what was this by you?
We and LA County Fair added a week.
Added a week, okay.
Yeah. And so LA, we'd been at longer. The State Fair understood it. California State Fair was the first 10-year contract ever given to a carnival in the state of California. There's 87 fairs in California, and everybody was working with a 1 to 3 year contract. And so when we made the jump there, Norb Bartosik, who was the manager at the time, I told Norb, I said, Norb, I can't do this without a 10-year contract. And he said, all right. So he put together a 10-year contract and got it pushed through the state. And so anyway.
That's pretty neat. There's not too many people that can, you know, just casually say they give up a state fair, a place. Yeah. Other thing. But I guess that's, if there's a downside, it's not really a downside, but one of the difficulties of having one unit, you know, something like that, is that you only have so many weeks in the year that you can do things. So you have to make some choices and compromises thing. Playing in California, is it tough with the regulation and things that are going on, or they're not too bad?
It's difficult. They keep coming up with stuff that you can't dream up. I mean, I don't know where they come up with this stuff at, but and unfortunately, there's only one fair. I think there's 2 events in the state of California that are not controlled by the government, by the state.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And Los Angeles is one of them. Los Angeles is a privately run fair. You know, it's a lot like, and the bigger fairs in this country are privately run, most of them. So, or nonprofits, either one.
Nonprofit organizations.
Yeah.
So you know, ride wise too, you've had, you know, Jim Bishop and some independents that have been around you for a while. Like, how did you, what was your strategy with it? Cause that's kind of like when Frank Conklin came to the US, that he basically had all the big rides and then he booked independents to take care of the menial work, I guess you'd say. And he moved all that big stuff, but you were, I'm not going to say you're the same, but you kind of had that, a little bit of that notion at some points.
Well, Jim Bishop, in 1980, when Ray bought Art Fraser, Jim Bishop was working with Art Fraser. And so we just picked him up when he bought the company. They just came along with the contract at the time. And when we lost the New Mexico State Fair, he was one of them that didn't drive away. He said, "Where are we going next?" And I said, "Well, we're going to figure it out. I don't know, but we got to figure it out." And he said, "Okay." And he stuck with us way back then. And so he's been with us ever since. And now his family and, you know, his brother and all those people are all with us.
That's neat.
They do a good job.
Part of the family.
Yep. Part of the family. That's right.
What other things, you know, for employees do you do differently than most? I mentioned before the break rooms or it's not a break room. I don't even know what it is. It's like a complex basically for your people when they're off a little bit. And
it's an employee lounge. It's an employee lounge. Employee lounge. We have a store there too, a general store. So they don't have to leave the midway to, you know, in the middle of the day to run, get something that they need. They can pick up any of the toiletries, any of that kind of stuff there. Uniforms are already also out of that same location. So it's nice because you got to give them breaks. You know, everybody in our company now is paid by the hour except management. And so we work them just the same as you would at any job. Also, our management's all, you know, they're on medical, they have medical programs. We have a retirement program. There's a lot. Carnival companies don't do this. You know, we have a traveling school. And I followed some of the different companies in California that were doing that. They're putting in gyms for their employees. They put in, you know, daycare centers for their employees. We tried the daycare. That didn't work out real good. But the school is working out fantastically. And we get some really, really sharp kids out of there. I tell people, I've got two of my grandkids out of the 26 went in there out of public school, and they were one grade, when they tested in, they were one grade level below. When they graduated from the traveling carnival, they were one grade above their standard. So, you know, smaller environment, not in a public school like they were, and it works out better. There's no doubt about it. And we've got a great set of teachers and a great board that runs that school. So it works out good.
What curriculum do you use?
Texas curriculum.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all out of Texas. And our head teacher, Kate Bishop, in fact, Eric Bishop's wife, she was a special ed teacher, and she really does a fantastic job with it. She just does great.
Yeah, that one-on-one or the closeness with the kids really makes a big difference.
I think last year was one of our bigger years. I think we had 17 kids in there. So, but they're taking field trips all the time. They go to museums. They just do all kinds of stuff. It's really neat. They went to Washington, D.C. one year, all flew back there, got the tour and stuff. Yeah.
That's really neat.
And she follows, and so do we, the other schools that are in our industry too. And they're all, I think, on the same page. I think all the other schools in the industry do the same.
How many are there? Do you have
I think there's three total. I think there's three, maybe four.
Does Degler still have one? Degler had one early.
Yep.
That Linda, I forget her name. And I think Conklin had one at some time.
Yep.
That's neat.
Well, it isn't just for our employees either. I mean, for our family, it's for employees. You know, they have their kids in there and they love it. That's the best part. We had a little girl come up last year from Mexico with her mom and dad. Couldn't speak a word of English. She was 6 years old. I'll guarantee you within less than 3 months, she was speaking as well as I'm speaking to you right now in English. And she couldn't speak a word of it when she came.
It's funny you mentioned that. My one of my daughters just graduated from University of Virginia, and her boyfriend was a Spanish major. And, you know, I always think about things with the carnival, but I said, you know, you could make a nice living if you came up with like a little ESL program and went to some of these carnivals, maybe went there for a few months or something like that and taught everybody English, especially, you know, the thing is that there'd be such a need for that. I think really for a continuing or adult education to learn English, because you have so many of these shows, you know, that some of the guys, their English isn't so great, but they had a little bit of schooling on that. They really might, I know you learn naturally some things because you're around other people that speak English, but you know, to teach people English would be a tremendous good, I think, for everybody around, including the owners.
Our daughter Joy, who's married to Ben Pickett, took Spanish all the way through school, and she's as fluent as they come, and just unbelievable. She's blonde haired. I mean, you know, when she'll stand there and listen to these newcomers and say, oh, and pretty soon they'll say something that she likes or doesn't like, and she comments on it, and they just are blown away.
But she knows Spanish.
Oh yeah, yep.
That's speaking of family. So go through who works for you and your family, and what their roles are, and even extended family, I guess.
We have Charlene and I have six children. We've got five girls and one boy, 26 grandchildren and their husbands or wives. And we've got 26 grandchildren, and number 9 great grandchild is on its way. Wow. Out of our six children, 3 of the families work with us in the company. And the other 3, Melissa Blomsus, you know, Jeff Blomsus was the one that bought name with Danny Houston a couple of times. And their son is married to Melissa, our number four daughter. And number 5, her husband is into construction. He builds custom homes and industrial places. So, yeah.
But what are the ones that work for the carnival? What are their roles?
Jody and Chris Lopez. Chris Lopez is in management. He's on our executive team. And Jody was running our commissary and food stands. She's our oldest. Second is Kim Palmieri and Dominic. Of course, he runs food, and he's our Midway gourmet. I don't know if you've seen his stuff on TV, on the channel or not. Ben Pickett and Joy, and they're gonna be the continuation of Ray Kamik shows. So
that's great. And they all have big roles, right? They all do.
They carry a lot of weight. Yep, they do.
They do their thing. So lately, you've been you've kind of become the king of wheels in the United States to a certain extent, huh? You put up quite a few. I never knew you. I'm from New Jersey. I'm right up the road from. And I was talking to somebody one time, because, you know, Guy Levitt owns that. Or I said, I had no idea, but I pass it all the time at the Meadowlands over there. That's where I grew up, right around there. My mom still lives there, and sisters, but I see it all the time when I go home. I'll see it Christmas when I go up. But how'd you get into that? I mean, you had one yourself, but then it just blossomed into something else.
Yeah, we'd been looking for locations to put stationary wheels. They do quite well when they're in the right location. They got to have a lot of tourism and stuff. So when everybody else took off during COVID, we went to Miami and started putting up the first one down in Miami, right on the waterfront there at Bayside Marketplace. We actually started erecting it before we got the city permit, because it was 3 years getting a permit there. Jeez. And so when COVID rolled around, I said, let's just go ahead and start putting this thing up. They've got to do something here. I mean, you know, it has to work out. And so we did. And we put it in the air, and pretty soon the city came around and said, oh, here's your permit. So, and it's been great. Yeah, it's been great ever since.
Right next door, you have Hialeah, and they're worse than Miami, believe it or not. Yeah. I did an event there once, and one of the council women was really friendly with us. And I was like, what is going on? And what was happening behind the scenes, the property owner and one of the the mayor or somebody were fighting each other. I said, you know, because there's so many Cubans there in Hialeah. I said, I think it would be easier to get a Kermit in Cuba than it would to get it in Hialeah. It was the craziest thing I ever dealt with in my life. It was nuts.
It would. The 5 city council members in Miami are all Cuban.
Yeah.
So,
just fighting over everything. And I was in this fight that I didn't even know who was fighting. They were just fighting behind the scenes. And I was like, what the heck? They're like, you have to have a detailed plan. And then I pulled one of the other permits from like a church carnival. It was written on a piece of paper in crayon or something. Yeah. I said, how is this okay? And mine's not okay. It was nuts.
You're so exactly
sorry
right.
for interrupting, but you went to Miami and New Jersey too?
Then we went, yeah, then we got, I got a call, and the Gourmazians, who own the mall in Rutherford, East Rutherford, called up and said, we've got a wheel that was supposed to go up in the original build of this shopping center, and it's over here in the storage lot. Would you come up and take a look at it and see what we can do with it? So I went up there, and they forgot to paint it when they got it from Italy, and it was just a mass of rust, and all the critical components and the finished edges and stuff were all just rusty. And I said, I wouldn't touch this with a 10-foot pole. So long story short, we cut a deal and we wound up putting a 80 meter up there on a 51 foot platform because the entrance is on the third floor of the shopping center.
Yeah.
As you've seen. Yeah. So, and that's been fun.
Out of the roof or whatever it is. It's like a massive thing.
And we had a ball putting that wheel up. Number one, we stayed in our motorhome in the parking lot, which was kind of fun for almost a year, erecting this thing. But the little towns around there, they were just wonderful little towns. The people were just great. Restaurants were fantastic. We had a great time.
Restaurants, Italian, especially around there.
And then on the weekends, Charlene and I'd sneak into the city and, you know, do that and come back on the weekdays and go back to work. And the only disadvantage to the whole thing and the part that I did care for was the unions. Had I known that in the beginning, I would have never done the project.
And actually, they're not as quite as bad as some of the New York ones. I did an event in Long Island at Nassau Coliseum once. We used to get by the fence. It was like $5,000 to get the fence. They'd erect it. Done. We go to Nassau Coliseum, pay the $5,000, put the first piece up. Union comes out. Nope. You got to have a teamster, a carpenter. And their carpenters were guys, they're not carpenters. They didn't even know how to hold the hammer. They were just screwing the screw in. But 10,000 additional on top of it. So it was 15,000 to put up the same fence. But, as you're young and learning those things, you become really jaded on that. It's like, why is there an extra $10,000 cost to do the same work? You know, it's
right.
Okay. And at $1,000 or something, because you have experts or something. Oh, okay. That's no big deal. But triple the prices. That really gets you annoyed, with what you're doing.
It's ridiculous. It was ridiculous. Ben actually booked when we were there putting the wheel up, and Ben was helping me with both of the wheels, from day one. But a promoter came to us when we were putting up the R80 in New Jersey, and he said, New York wants to do an event during COVID. You know, it's kind of right at the end of COVID. He said to help, get people's morale back up. And he said, do you have any more wheels? And Ben says, absolutely. We've got a 33 meter, and they put it up in Times Square with the unions. And we set it right on top of the subway train was underneath of it. So we had to have a subway person there monitoring everything that we were doing, which I wanted that. I mean, you didn't want anything different.
Disaster.
But here we are putting this wheel up. It looked like a little toy in the middle of all these tall, high rise buildings. But it was fantastic and well received, and it was fun. It was just a fun thing to do. The only other time they'd ever had a wheel in Manhattan was the year after World War II ended, for a celebration for the ticker tape parade or something. Yeah. So
that's the thing about New York. If most of the time it's really difficult, but when they want to do something,
opened every door. That's right. It's amazing.
It's unbelievable. It really is. Woolman Rink, and when Trump made the rink over there, he got it done real quick. It was they were working on it for decades or something. Yep. It was crazy.
Absolutely.
Doing that whole thing. Ride wise now, how are you? Are you still buying stuff? Are you still looking ahead? You still
We are. Unfortunately, a lot of these manufacturers are 2 and 3 years out right now.
I know we might both be retired by the time they.
Yeah, we've got I think three more new rides coming. I couldn't even tell you what they are yet, and shouldn't tell you what they are yet until we get them, for consummated. We just got a new Heidi coaster this last year. That was great, and every year there's three or four new rides coming every year.
Every year for the next foreseeable. A lot of people bought a lot of stuff during the post-pandemic, when things were good, which is pretty exciting because there's always something new to see or look at. I was asking one of the ride manufacturers at IAPA, I was like, did some of the guys ask you for insurance policies on you now, especially if it's a small shop, like make sure you're around in 5 years when you're promising these rides that you're holding the money. It's crazy. I mean, it really is nuts. I mean, talking about all that down the road so far, it's a crazy time. Do you see the health of the carnival business pretty good right now? Or do you see the, not just with Ray Kamik shows, but with everybody, you think, I see some people entering the business now that get bigger a little bit.
Yeah, I think people are always going to, everybody says, aren't computers going to take over and, all the Game Boys and those kind of things? I said, no. People still want to feel their stomach drop out, getting on a ride. They can't do that without actually experiencing it. And I think it's the camaraderie too. I think going out and being in the crowds and, you know, watching people have fun and things. It's like going to, you know, the boardwalk and which food stand you're going to go up to. You're going to go up to the one with the big long line on it. That people like that. People like to be involved in doing that kind of stuff. So I think we have to treat customers right. I think that, you know, the messaging and stuff is just so instantaneous nowadays that you got to watch all your P's and Q's. That's for sure.
I do. Yeah. I remember Jeff, I think it was Jeff Blomzis said, and it was when AB was still around, that he was scared of the casinos, that the casinos were going to kill our business or something like that. And I'm with you. I don't know, maybe I'm crazily optimistic, but I always think you need a carnival or a fair or something like that, because it's a different experience. It's not the same thing. You know, it's so much fun. It's so great for the families and the memories you make and all those things. It's a tremendous business. It really is.
It is. And the casinos are for adults. So, you know, the kids, the teenagers and the college kids, that's our customers. They're the ones that come out and spend the money. Obviously they're the ones that have the money to spend. They don't have the payments and all that kind of stuff. So that's helpful. The casinos do take away the entertainment for the fairs. I feel for these fairs. Fairs are having a tough time getting entertainment, you know.
Especially big names, yeah.
Yeah, unless they have big venues like Houston, you know, where you can seat 80,000 people. You can get top of the name entertainment when you seat that many people, because you can pay for them. Their prices have gone up so much.
Yeah, but they have. They're crazy. But I was telling a couple of podcasts, I was eating dinner one day, and I was just watching TV. I was like at a restaurant. I was traveling. And I saw this show that had all these acts that did incredible things. I mean, just incredible things. And I don't think we're capitalizing on that as an industry, because, you know, we just have the same old thing. You know, we got to move that continuum a little bit, because there were so many things. Yes, they have to develop it as an act and all those things. But I wonder if anybody's looking, you know, and going, hey, you could have a great act. Let me talk to you. I could book you so many weeks, because they did. I was fascinated for like an hour. I was like, wow, that's great. Yep. You know, maybe five or six were really cool. We got to change. You know, we can't just do the same old thing, I guess.
If you do, you're going to get stagnant and then it doesn't work. It doesn't work.
You know, you mentioned before, I've never asked you this, but I'm just out of curiosity. But when NAME was coming together originally with Michael Solomon and all those guys, did they ever approach you about coming in?
We were the second ones they approached.
Yes. I mean, it would make sense. Oh, yeah. I just never heard your name in association with it too much.
At the time, with family involved, it was pretty tough to look at that. You know, you can look back now and say, oh, well, we could have done this, could have done that. But at the time, we just sat down as a family and said, what do we want to do? You know? And
yeah, so, I think as an exit strategy, like for, you know, say Frank Conklin, who wanted to get out,
sure,
it was a great thing. But for somebody like yourself who has generations of family and they want to continue to operate, it's a yep, tough thing to do. But, you know, I always thought it was a little, at least the original one was, I was tangentially involved with some people that were involved with it. And I just thought the business plan was weird, because he wanted to take over the car. He sounded like he wanted to take over the fairs, but he wanted to buy the carnivals, and it didn't make sense to me. I was like, the fair is a different entity. You know, they hired a carnival. The carnival's not in charge.
Right. The one thing they didn't do, and when we were talking to Michael Solomon, I said, because he was talking about sponsorships and advertisement and that nationwide, and I said, that's fantastic. I would be really interested in that. When you can get the Northwest added to this, you know, because we were kind of the Southwest, and he was covering almost the entire United States. And I said, and you need to do Canada, which he did. Then I said, you've got something. But he never picked up that last little leg of it, and that just kind of turned me off at the time, I guess.
Well, also, so they rolled like into West Palm, South Florida fair. And they said, we're going to put these sponsors in. And then they said, no, you're not.
Yeah, exactly.
It's our fair. Or are you going to give us the money? They're like, no. What do you mean? Yeah. It's ours. And I think they were shocked, you know, sort of by that to a certain extent, because they, you know, they thought they were in charge, I guess, to a certain extent. But
right.
It just didn't happen with that.
Well, that's not them not knowing the industry. That was a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a lot of people get confused. They think the carnival is the fair or vice versa. Like it's the same thing. It's like you want to take over the malls and you bought Chick-fil-A or something. It's like, no, it's not the same thing. It's a part of it. It's a big part of it maybe, but it's not the same thing.
That's right.
That's great. So do you have grandchildren now involved with the business a little bit working, or none of them old enough?
Well, yeah, no, our second to oldest grandson, our oldest grandson just graduated from law school. That's Kim and Dominic's son.
You need one of those.
Yeah. I said, why not? Might as well. His grandmother on the other side is an attorney also. But our second grandson, Cade Lopez, is down in Miami. He's managing that wheel and doing a quite nice job there. He's getting married in June this year. So
congratulations.
Yeah.
I've got five girls too, two boys, but do you feel for the girls are a little bit tougher sometimes when you're raising them. But they say, they age me. They say they age me, but I feel pretty good with most of them. But
wait till the weddings come along. That's
the one came already. My daughter Mary just had a baby actually, but and she works with me, so she's okay. But the other ones, and it's always the tier of the one before. I'm like, well, you let them do that, or you bought them that, and you know, it just grows because they keep pushing the bar up there. But
I've always said the best part of our industry, though, and I love this about it, is that we get to work with our kids and our grandkids now.
Your family. It's fantastic to see.
And they get to learn how to work. They get to learn how to, you know, do the business. And we put them in. So when they're real small, they can go in ticket boxes or food stands or that kind of stuff. And then, you know, they can work up from there. But we've got some kids out there, related grandkids, and our employees have kids now, you know, that work out there. So it's a wonderful thing. I enjoy that. Yep. Multi-generation. That's for sure.
Well, Guy, we've been talking an hour. I can't believe it, but
oh my God,
I really appreciate the.
You said 30 minutes. You said 30 minutes.
I did. 2 hours.
That's great.
When Phil Vivona got done, he's like, I could have talked for 8 more hours, you know. Here's the thing. So hopefully I'll get you back on at some point. I really appreciate you getting up early, and I appreciate all you do with the carnival. Everybody should go visit Ray Kamik shows. I don't care if you're the most jaded carnival owner who thinks you know everything. You'll learn something out there for sure.
Thank you, and best to your family.
And everybody, and hopefully we'll see you soon or in Gibtown or someplace.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Have a Merry Christmas.
You too.
All right.
This podcast is brought to you by Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Our staff of professionals can guide you through your setup, assist with customer service, even on the weekends when you most need it, and help increase your sales through promotions that work. Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Sign up today at innovativeticketing.com.